Progressive Radio Network.
From New York City, it's the Gary Moore Show. Baker, I say a little prayer for you. And while comb in my hair now, and wondering and now, what your host, Gary Moore. I say a little prayer for you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting on location, but today on a portable radio station, not a telephone. We're going to talk about the latest in health and healing. That's good. And then I'm going to provide someone that you probably have never heard of, a discerning information on a topic that we all are currently aware of, the accusation that the doctor challenging Kavanaugh said with 100% certainty that he was the one who attacked her. Okay, that may be true. We don't know. In fact, my office is doing its own independent investigation with a team of investigative reporters. And we believe in our own way we will be able to get to the bottom of the truth, whatever it may be. Right now, we have accusations and denial, but we don't have absolute proof. But then again, in America, we must begin with the assumption that a person is innocent until proven guilty, and that doesn't seem to be fashionable. In fact, right now, all over the internet, the idea is that you're guilty if someone challenges you, and if it's a woman, you're automatically guilty, and if you're white male, you're guilty of everything. You shouldn't have been born. The hatred I see is palpable, destructive, and does not help anyone. What's not being focused upon are any of the issues that actually matter in our society. For example, 16 million hungry children, 2.5 million homeless children, 3 million Americans making under $5 a day. And then we can go through 100 other things that are not being addressed. Environmental degradation. What's going to happen when your insurance doesn't cover your damage, whether it's a hurricane, a tornado, a flood? These are real issues. The idea that we have politics and money combined from the most powerful billionaires in the world who want to control the laws of our land. That was never intended and should not be acceptable. Yet it's not even on anyone's talking points. So we're going to try to deal with what's really important, the important and essential issues to our life. We're going to talk about that, and we're going to have on a professor today. If you have not heard of her, you will. Professor Elizabeth Loftus. And she is going to talk about how accurate is your memory. So you think you saw someone? You're 100% certain? Well, before you accept that as a given, she has some insights that will cause us to stop and pause and reflect. So we have a lot to do today, and I will open the calls up later on after her presentation for your feedback. But we begin with Boston University School of Medicine. Stress reduces women's fertility. Now, we know alcohol reduces it. We know that different synthetic chemicals in the environment, including the outgassing of plastics, and there are at least 80,000 human-made chemicals that are disruptive to our hormones. And that's why you shouldn't be cooking with aluminum. You shouldn't be using microwave. You shouldn't be boiling things, as they now suggest, in little plastic pouches, because the moment the heat hits the plastic, it releases the plastic molecules into the food. Those are hormone disruptors. So if you choose to be fertile, then you're going to have to de-stress as well as clean up your body. Now, about 25% of women, 18 to 21, are having problems, severe problems, because of psychological stress. Now, a lot of people are stressed, but I guess when you're going through college, you're in college, And that's when a lot of this happens, or you can't go to college and you're trying to find work, or you've got work but the work isn't paying you enough. There's any myriad of reasons why we're having difficulty in our society today, coping. That disrupts your hormones. And this is according to an article published in the American Journal of Epidemiology. So what's the answer? De-stressing. Mindful meditation. Taking walks. Being near nature. All of that helps. Also from the University of Bordeaux, which is in France, a new study confirms that the Mediterranean diet prevents a leading cause of blindness. That's correct. Evidence is mounting that a poor diet plays an important role in the development of age-related macular degeneration, a leading cause of blindness in the United States. And a large collaboration of researchers from the European Union investigating the connection between genes and lifestyle on the development of the age-related macular degeneration has found that people who adhere to a Mediterranean diet, which is rich in fruits and vegetables, beans, which are very popular over there, and legumes, and starchy vegetables and fish, have a substantial benefit in protecting their vision. And this was published in the peer-reviewed Ophthalmology Journal, which is the Journal of the American Academy of Ophthalmology. So, a healthy plant-based diet protects your vision, your eyes. From the Federal University of Pampa in Brazil, green tea is a safe natural remedy for brain hemorrhaging. Here's one reason to have a cup of green tea, or if you can't do that, just take about a 200 milligram supplement of green tea, because the researchers have found that green tea is used to prevent brain damage after profuse bleeding. And a lot of people have strokes, and that can also be one of the causes. And when people get angry, especially when they get angry and they lose their temper, start yelling, that's when you're likely to have a microstroke. That's a mini stroke. And this was published in Neuroscience International. And according to the American Heart Association, at least 13% of all strokes in the United States are classified as hemorrhagic strokes. The condition occurs when a weakened blood vessel is ruptured and bleeds into the surrounding brain, where it accumulates and adds pressure to surrounding brain tissue. Now, there are two kinds of hemorrhagic stroke. There is what is known as the intracerebral and also the subarachnoid, and these are the two most common. So you don't want any stroke, and as I've mentioned many times, I just counseled someone this morning on this. Take vitamin C. When you get above 1,000 milligrams, when you're at 1,500, 2,000, 3,000 milligrams, you're really thinning the blood, including the blood going into the brain. And that's anti-inflammatory. When you're taking green tea, what I just mentioned, at 200 to 1,000 milligrams, you're also protecting the brain and the blood. And also vitamin E in two forms, the tocopherols and the tocotrienols together, generally at 400 units, and coenzyme Q10 ubiquinol at anywhere from 200 to 600 milligrams. And magnesium is great for the brain also, generally 500 to 1,000 milligrams. So these will help you prevent a stroke, as will cayenne pepper. But if you should have a stroke, they also help lessen the damage of it. And then you should have hyperbaric oxygen therapy immediately upon having a stroke. Just remember that. Even if your doctor is unaware of the literature or how powerful it is, they'll say, well, that's for the bins, for divers. Yes, and about 26 other medical conditions it's been able to benefit, but especially stroke. From Rostock University Medical Center in Germany, medical cannabis treats cancer and boosts the immune system, and they reviewed 100 studies to come up with that finding. That's right. A recently authored review of 100 studies in the peer-reviewed literature showed that cannabis CannabisCannabis, really is medicinal, even if the U.S. federal government, for political reasons only, to recognize it. The scientific analysis has shown that the cannabinoid compound found in marijuana can stop cancer cells from dividing and spreading, and can even cut off blood supply to tumors. Well, that's good news. So just understand that a team of German researchers led by Professor Burkhard Heinz, H-I-N-Z, conducted the review, and they found that cannabis compounds can fight cancer. That's important for everyone who has cancer. Also, drinking more water reduces infections in women, bladder infections. This is the University of Texas Southwest Medical Center. And in the controlled trial, women who drank an additional 1.5 liters of water daily experienced 48% fewer repeated bladder infections than those who drank their usual volume of fluids. So that's not difficult. That's about 6 8-ounce glasses of water a day. Quote, that's a significant difference, said the chief of urology and oncology at the medical center. These findings are important because more than half of all women report having bladder infections, and that could help stop them. So that's good. And this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in Internal Medicine. Also, from the University of Connecticut, more children in the United States than ever before in our history are eating fast foods, despite health concerns. Interesting, because yesterday I had to get a haircut. I had forgotten to get a haircut for so long, and it was down to my hair was down to my shoulders, and I needed it cleaned up. So I went around, and there was no place to get a haircut. And then someone told me, I said, why is every place closed here? Oh, every place is closed on Monday. And so I said, okay, any place, all they see over there. So I went over to a place right by Walmart. And while I was standing waiting to get in, I'm looking at every person coming out of the store. And every child with a parent particularly was of interest to me because they were all obese. Not just overweight, obese. And I'm talking about obese and morbidly obese. So I went inside and I put on hold my hair appointment for a moment. I came back out and I'm watching this. And I just couldn't believe that I didn't see a single healthy person walk out of the store. And then after my haircut, I came back out, which was like $12. I came back out and I was just fascinated. I don't know if anyone's ever done a study. It'd be worth thinking about someone in the audience doing it, a citizen journalist. Go to go to a Walmart store or one of the box stores, and when people come out, especially with food, just ask them politely, could you interview them, because you're looking for why people buy certain foods. And if it's an unhealthy food, an obviously unhealthy food, are they aware that it's unhealthy? Maybe they're not aware. You want to ask them politely, because there's no point in... You're not there to confront them. You're not there to change them. You're just there to get input. Why are you buying these particular foods? So that you can get their perspective on it. Because these, Louisiana, Texas, Mississippi, West Virginia, Alabama, these are the most obese states in America and with the worst health. And nothing is being done by the Surgeon General, the U.S. Public Health Service, the CDC, or the FDA to help these poor people. They need help, not criticism. Well, this study at the University of Connecticut, the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity, published their findings, and they found that the number of children in the United States eating fast food is rising. So that's not good, because when that obesity link goes up, so does diabetes and heart disease. And they frequently stay obese, frequently the rest of their life. Also, finally, from McMaster's University, which is in Canada, the health-related quality of life is completely overlooked in cancer drug studies. A McMaster's University-led review and analysis of randomized clinical trials is questioning whether interventions which prolong progression-free survival in cancer patients improve their health-related quality of life. And they took a look at over 13,979 cancer patients across 12 types of cancer. And all they're looking at is, do they live longer? Not whether or not what they're given improves the quality of their life. This was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Now, I spoke with a woman who should be dead but is alive, and her oncologist suggested radiation, and a couple months ago, I would not have recommended that radiation, but she chose it, and now she's suffering severe pain, pain that is so severe that it forces a person onto Percocet and different opiate medication, which disrupts the quality of life. The radiation, in my opinion, wasn't necessary. The person had no cancer anywhere in her body. It had gone. She had been on a very specific protocol, and it worked. But they wanted, quote, for insurance, give her this. Well, if you look at the scientific literature, radiation is carcinogenic. It causes cancer, as does chemotherapy. That is not to suggest that radiation cannot shrink tumors. It can, but then you destroy the immune system in the process, so you're cancer-free for a year or two. But what happens when the immune system is collapsed and the cancer comes back and now you don't have the same immunity you had before to help the body fight it? So shouldn't we be demanding from the orthodox establishment not just a drug therapy or radiation therapy for cancer, but also quality of life? But they won't do it because, A, there's no money in it, and why should they? Even if they don't care about your quality of life, they do care about the amount of money they make on cancer drugs, and it's huge. You're dealing in tens of billions of dollars per year. That's the latest on health and healing. We're 18 minutes into our program. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break and come right back. Oh, by the way, before we go, from Clemson University, a new study shows that yoga can help Parkinson's disease. How about that? Published in a peer-reviewed journal. So, to those of you who would have read Wikipedia and thought, well, yoga doesn't do anything, oh, yeah, it does. And there's a whole lot more that it does, but this one shows that it helps Parkinson's. So I wouldn't go to Wikipedia for anything any longer, nor would I support it. But that's just me. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. For all of our stations around the world, we thank you very much for carrying this program. And for all the people listening and sharing the information, good for you. We have articles galore, original ones that we write ourselves and research. And just to let you know that we are doing our own independent investigation in the claims of Dr. Ford and those who support her. And we will give you the results as soon as we feel that we have a conclusion that's objective and fair. In the interim, for those who said, I support her, I believe her, without any evidence, even before she testified, wow. So if you were on a jury and there was a person being charged with rape, would you say they're guilty? I believe her. Why have this trial? There's no need for evidence. Guilty. Okay, so you want to put the burden of proof upon what? The person who's being accused? We know that it's not possible to prove a negative, or to disprove a negative. So it's like saying, prove to me that you didn't do it. No, that's not the way our system works, thank goodness. And here's someone that you have probably not heard of. She's the distinguished professor of psychology and social behavior. She's also a professor of law. She's one of the smartest people on the planet. Her name is Elizabeth F. Loftus, L-O-F-T-U-S. She also is the joint appointment in psychology and social behavior, criminology and law and society, and cognitive sciences in the School of Law. Talk about a heavyweight. She is one, and I recently saw a lecture she gave at Harvard University. So what we're going to play for you now is her giving us her insights of why people are absolutely certain that something happened to them because they remember it. And frequently they remember it only after they have been given some form of psychotherapy. Wow. Boy, do you see where this is going. Listen in now and make up your own mind about what she has to say, and then put that in the context of what we're seeing today in America.
Tell you about a legal case that I worked on involving a man named Steve Titus. Titus was a restaurant manager. He was 31 years old. He lived in Seattle, Washington. He was engaged to Gretchen, about to be married. She was the love of his life. And one night, the couple went out for a romantic restaurant meal. They were on their way home, and they were pulled over by a police officer. You see, Titus's car sort of resembled a car that was driven earlier in the evening by a man who raped a female hitchhiker. And Titus kind of resembled that rapist. So the police took a picture of Titus. They put it in a photo lineup. They later showed it to the victim. And she pointed to Titus's photo. She said, "That one's the closest." The police and the prosecution proceeded with a trial, and when Steve Titus was put on trial for rape, the rape victim got on the stand and said, "I'm absolutely positive that's the man." And Titus was convicted. He proclaimed his innocence. His family screamed at the jury. His fiance collapsed on the floor sobbing, and Titus is taken away to jail. So what would you do? At this point, what would you do? Well, Titus lost complete faith in the legal system, and yet he got an idea. He called up the local newspaper. He got the interest of an investigative journalist, and that journalist actually found the real rapist, a man who ultimately confessed to this rape, a man who was thought to have committed 50 rapes in that area. And when this information was given to the judge set Titus free. And really, that's where this case should have ended. It should have been over. Titus should have thought of this as a horrible year, a year of accusation and trial, but over. It didn't end that way. Titus was so bitter. He'd lost his job. He couldn't get it back. He lost his fiance. She couldn't put up with his persistent anger. He lost his entire savings, and so he decided to file a lawsuit against the police and others whom he felt were responsible for his suffering. And that's when I really started working on this case, trying to figure out how did that victim go from "that one's the closest" to "I'm absolutely positive that's the guy." Well, Titus was consumed with his civil case as he spent every waking moment thinking about it. And just days before he was to have his day in court, he woke up in the morning, doubled over in pain, and died of a stress-related heart attack. He was 35 years old. So I was asked to work on Titus's case because I'm a psychological scientist. I study memory. I've studied memory for decades. And if I meet somebody on an airplane, this happened on the way over to Scotland, if I meet somebody on an airplane and we ask each other, "What do you do? What do you do?" And I say, "I study memory," they usually want to tell me how they have trouble remembering names, or they've got a relative who's got Alzheimer's or some kind of memory problem. But I have to tell them, I don't study when people forget. I study the opposite. When they remember things that didn't happen or remember things that were different from the way they really were, I study false memories. Unhappily, Steve Titus is not the only person to be convicted based on somebody's false memory. In one project in the United States, information has been gathered on 300 innocent people, 300 defendants who were convicted of crimes they didn't do. They spent 10, 20, 30 years in prison for these crimes, and now DNA testing has proven that they're actually innocent. And when those cases have been analyzed, 3/4 of them are due to faulty memory, faulty eyewitness memory. Well, why? Like the jurors who convicted those innocent people and the jurors who convicted Titus, many people believe that memory works like a recording device. You just record the information, then you call it up and play it back when you want to answer questions or identify images. But decades of work in psychology has shown that this just isn't true. Our memories are constructive. They're reconstructive. Memory works a little bit more like a Wikipedia page. You can go in there and change it, but so can other people. I first started studying this constructive memory process in the 1970s. I did my experiments that involved showing people simulated crimes and accidents and asking them questions about what they remember. In one study, we showed people a simulated accident, and we asked people how fast were the cars going when they hit each other. And we asked other people how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other. And if we asked the leading smash question, the witnesses told us the cars were going faster. And moreover, that leading smashed question caused people to be more likely to tell us that they saw broken glass in the accident scene when there wasn't any broken glass at all. In another study, we showed a simulated accident where a car went through an intersection with a stop sign, and if we asked a question that insinuated it was a yield sign, many witnesses told us they remember seeing a yield sign at the intersection, not a stop sign. And you might be thinking, well, you know, these are filmed events. They're not particularly stressful. Would the same kind of mistakes be made with a really stressful event? In a study we published just a few months ago, we have an answer to this question. Because what was unusual about this study is we arranged for people to have a very stressful experience. The subjects in the study were members of the U.S. military who were undergoing a harrowing training exercise to teach them what it's going to be like for them if they are ever captured as prisoners of war. And as part of this training exercise, these soldiers are interrogated in an aggressive, hostile, physically abusive fashion for 30 minutes. And later on, they have to try to identify the person who conducted that interrogation. And when we feed them suggestive information that insinuates it's a different person, many of them misidentify their interrogator, often identifying someone who doesn't even remotely resemble the real interrogator. And so what these studies are showing is that when you feed people misinformation about some experience that they may have had, you can distort or contaminate or change their memory. Well, out there in the real world, misinformation is everywhere. We get misinformation not only if we're questioned in a leading way, but if we talk to other witnesses who might consciously or inadvertently feed us some erroneous information, or if we see media coverage about some event we might have experienced. All of these provide the opportunity for this kind of contamination of our memory. In the 1990s, we began to see an even more extreme kind of memory problem. Some patients were going into therapy with one problem. Maybe they had depression, eating disorder, And they were coming out of therapy with a different problem. Extreme memories for horrific brutalization, sometimes in satanic rituals, sometimes involving really bizarre and unusual elements. One woman came out of psychotherapy believing that she'd endured years of ritualistic abuse where she was forced into a pregnancy and that the baby was cut from her belly. But there were no physical scars or any kind of physical evidence that could have supported her story. And when I began looking into these cases, I was wondering, where do these bizarre memories come from? And what I found is that most of these situations involved some particular form of psychotherapy. And so I asked, were some of the things going on in this psychotherapy, like the imagination exercises, or dream interpretation, or in some cases hypnosis, or in some cases exposure to false information, were these leading these patients to develop these very bizarre, unlikely memories? And I designed some experiments to try to study the processes that were being used in this psychotherapy so I could study the development of these very rich false memories. In one of the first studies we did, we used suggestion, a method inspired by the psychotherapy we saw in these cases. We used this kind of suggestion and planted a false memory that when you were a kid, 5 or 6 years old, you were lost in a shopping mall. You were frightened. You were crying. You were ultimately rescued by an elderly person and reunited with the family. And we succeeded in planting this memory in the minds of about a quarter of our subjects. And you might be thinking, well, that's not particularly stressful. But we and other investigators have planted rich false memories of things that were much more unusual and much more stressful. So in a study done in Tennessee, researchers planted the false memory that when you were a kid, you nearly drowned and had to be rescued by a lifeguard. And in a study done in Canada, researchers planted the false memory that when you were a kid, something as awful as being attacked by a vicious animal happened to you, succeeding with about half of their subjects. And in a study done in Italy, researchers planted the false memory, when you were a kid, you witnessed demonic possession. I do want to add that it might seem like we are traumatizing these experimental subjects in the name of science, but our studies have gone through thorough evaluation by research ethics boards that have made the decision that the temporary discomfort that some of these subjects might experience in these studies is outweighed by the importance of this problem for understanding memory processes and the abuse of memory that is going on in some places in the world. Well, to my surprise, when I published this work and began to speak out against this particular brand of psychotherapy, it created some pretty bad problems for me. Hostilities primarily from the repressed memory therapists who felt under attack and by the patients whom they had influenced. I had sometimes armed guards at speeches that I was invited to give, people trying to drum up letter writing campaigns to get me fired. But probably the worst was I suspected that a woman was innocent of abuse that was being claimed by her grown daughter. She accused her mother of sexual abuse based on a repressed memory. And this accusing daughter had actually allowed her story to be filmed and presented in public places. I was suspicious of this story, and so I started to investigate and eventually found information that convinced me that this mother was innocent. I published an expose on the case, and a little while later, the accusing daughter filed a lawsuit. Even though I'd never mentioned her name, she sued me for defamation and invasion of privacy. And I went through nearly 5 years of dealing with this messy unpleasant litigation, but finally it was over and I could really get back to my work. In the process, however, I became part of a disturbing trend in America where scientists are being sued for simply speaking out on matters of great public controversy. When I got back to my work, I asked this question. If I plant a false memory in your mind, does it have repercussions? Does it affect your later thoughts, your later behaviors? Our first study planted a false memory that you got sick as a child, eating certain foods, hard-boiled eggs, dill pickles, strawberry ice cream, and we found that once we planted this false memory, people didn't want to eat the foods as much at an outdoor picnic. The false memories aren't necessarily bad or unpleasant. If we planted a warm, fuzzy memory involving a healthy food like asparagus, we could get people to want to eat asparagus more. And so what these studies are showing is that you can plant false memories and they have repercussions that affect behavior long after the memories take hold. Well, along with this ability to plant memories and control behavior, obviously comes some important ethical issues. Like, when should we use this mind technology, and should we ever ban its use? Therapists can't ethically plant false memories in the mind of their patients, even if it would help the patient. But there's nothing to stop a parent from trying this out on their overweight or obese teenager. And when I suggested this publicly, it created outcry again. There she goes. She's advocating that parents lie to their children. Hello, Santa Claus. I mean, another way another way to think about this is, which would you rather have? A kid with obesity, diabetes, shortened lifespan, all the things that go with it, or a kid with one little extra bit of false memory? I know what I would choose for a kid of mine. But maybe my work has made me different from most people. Most people cherish their memories, know that they represent their identity, who they are, where they came from. And I appreciate that. I feel that way too. But I know from my work how much fiction is already in there. If I've learned anything from these decades of working on these problems, it's this. Just because somebody tells you something and they say it with confidence, just because they say it with lots of detail, just because they express emotion when they say it, it doesn't mean that it really happened. We can't reliably distinguish true memories from false memories. We need independent corroboration. Such a discovery has made me more tolerant of the everyday memory mistakes that my friends and family members make. Such a discovery might have saved Steve Titus, the man whose whole future was snatched away by a false memory. But meanwhile, we should all keep in mind, we do well to, that memory, like liberty, is a fragile thing. Thank you.
And that is, you've been listening to Professor Elizabeth Loftus, Loftus, Distinguished Professor of Psychology and Social Behavior, Professor of Law and Criminology and Cognitive Science. So she's considered one of the greatest psychologists of the 20th century, and outstanding background. And she also is an expert on memory. And she has been an expert witness or consultant in hundreds of cases, including the McMartin preschool molestation case that never happened, but 66 separate parents said their child was sexually abused and gave great details. It was all a myth. It didn't happen. So we should pay some attention here, especially with the so-called certainty that's been given and the politics around it. I will wait and hold off judgment until I have done my own independent investigative reporting, and I have a team all working together. None of us are biased on any of these issues. I don't like the different legal precedents that Kavanaugh has come down on. Personally, I would not recommend him for the Supreme Court, but that is separate from conflating issues that he's automatically guilty because a whole group of people want him guilty. There's a danger to that because there's no evidence thus far from her, and her memory's all over the place. There's so many contradictions. When I was watching the testimony, I thought, my goodness, she is says she has a fear of flying, but then she's a world traveler. Well, which is it? And she, and there's also a lot about her background we're now researching about how detailed, specific is her study of psychology, and she was undergoing psychotherapy. And she specializes in memory. So how is it that she couldn't remember who drove her, where it was, the layout? There's too many inconsistencies to automatically assume that she's right, he's wrong, and therefore he's guilty and shouldn't be Supreme Court. If you don't want him to be Supreme Court, protest what you disagree with about him being a Supreme Court justice. That's legitimate. Just like protest against a president, support another candidate for the next presidential candidate race in 2020. That's legitimate. But don't support a coup that was engineered by the CIA and the White House under Obama and the FBI and the Justice Department, which is now being uncovered, which a grand jury is now hearing evidence on, which with all the emails and the evidence is irrefutable. There was a coup. It's just how many people were totally involved, and now they'll start to drop on each other. They'll drop a dime on each other, and then that'll come forward. Who's going to apologize for assuming that everything that these people did was correct when it was wrong? If you don't want a person in office, try to vote them out. That's legitimate. Engaging in illegalities is not. It's not the American way. Now, we're going to take a break and come back, and then I'm going to play you a second documentary from a expert, one of the world's leading experts on why you can't always trust eyewitnesses. Remember, right now, according to the best statistics I can find, 41% of all the people in prison are innocent and shouldn't be there. And you can't believe how corrupt our judicial system is. How many people were picked up without committing a crime or nothing more than a misdemeanor, you know, and then they can't afford bail. They can't afford legal representation. They cannot challenge the government's case because they have no resources. And so they're given a deal. Plead out and we'll give you a reduced sentence and that's it. You'll serve a short period of time in jail. And so the person says, well, what option do I have? And they don't have an option at that point. So they plead out 95% of the time. But then that becomes a record they can't get out of. And then we don't allow those people frequently to vote. They're considered pariah in society. Their opportunities to get employment are challenged. That whole system is wrong. And then time and again, how many people through the Innocence Project have been found free, even though there was 100% certainty the person was guilty of the crime, whether it's murder, rape, or whatever, but it never happened from that person. If there was a crime, it wasn't that person that committed it. But the witnesses were 100% certain. So we're going to take a look at that in just a moment. However, before we go there, I have something brand new and exciting to share with you, and it took me a long time to create this. And the reason I created this is because I was counseling a person about a year ago, and they were so jittery, and their body was, it actually had some like spastic movements. And I said, do you have Parkinsonian? Why are you having, no, man, I can't sleep a lot, and I have these energy drinks in the morning. And this morning I had two of them, and boy, I'm wired. Do you know what's in the energy drink? I don't really know everything that's in there. It's just it gives me energy. You know, you buy them in every service station, every store has got them. So I went out to the store, and I bought the four most popular energy drinks I could find. I then went to the Library of Medicine, and I looked under every ingredient, And for the next 3 weeks, I wrote up a report on what those ingredients contained. And then I thought, wow, this is really toxic stuff. Unfortunately, I didn't commit that to my computer. I was doing it in longhand. I recently did it all over again with someone in the office who researched it and came up with even more devastating information that if you actually go through every ingredient in those energy drinks and then compare that to the scientific literature, just Google library medicine and what it caffeine and then how much caffeine and the other ingredients, and you think, I would never want that in my body. So my challenge was, can I create an energy drink that's all natural, without caffeine, without artificial stimulants, that will give a person natural energy rather than synthetic energy? And as of today, the answer is yes. Just arrived in our warehouse. We call it Energy Stuff. Delicious orange flavor. You get 30 servings. It's all vegan. And here are my ingredients, and you can Google these and see all the scientific literature supporting them. Organic cordyceps, which is the mushroom, coenzyme Q10, D-ribose, vitamin B12, acetyl-L-carnitine, Panax ginseng, green tea extract, L-carnosine, electrolytes, sodium citrate, magnesium citrate, and potassium citrate. Don't see that. You don't see the football players on Sunday drinking that. Ginkgo biloba extract, cayenne pepper, rhodiola, rosea, L-taurine, L-arginine, creatine monohydrate, orange stevia, and organic evaporated cane juice and natural flavors. That's it. So this is the real McCoy. This is what you want if you need energy. And there's only 2 grams of total natural sugar in there, and 2 grams protein also. So it's called Energy Stuff, brand new, never offered before. As of today, it's on sale. And you'll call this number, and I'm even giving you a special introductory discount. It's normally $78, you're getting it for $63. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. One last time, 877-627-5065, and ask for Energy Stuff. I give you the ingredients. You can Google them and look them up. Then look at the energy stuff or the energy drink you're drinking. Compare it to mine. It's night and day, totally opposite. So for the first time, an all-natural energy drink, it's actually a powder. You can put it in any liquid. And I know a lot of you could use extra energy at different times of the day. I take this now and have been taking it before I do my run in the morning. It's phenomenal. And when I have a long stretch where I might not be able to have any other nourishment, before I go on a plane, Energy Stuff. So now you have it, my brand new product, my own creation, Energy Stuff. And needless to say, it's the Rolls Royce of what all these products could have been, but they were into making the profit, and I'm in to helping give you the energy your body requires when it's needed. Oh, and one last thing. For over a year, we have been out of Supremacy Cherry Chewables. As of today, they're back in inventory. And again, they're on sale for $29.99, 180 chewable tablets. And this is the vitamin C from ascorbic acid, selenium, magnesium, zinc, potassium, and manganese. It's ascorbates, acerola cherry flavor, and it's just terrific. And it's vegan, and we've been out of it a long time, and people have wanted it. And I said, okay, so we got the magnesium ascorbate, the zinc ascorbate, the potassium ascorbate, the magnesium ascorbate, the acerola cherry, and brought it all back together again in this delicious tasting product. So, just to let you know, Supremacy Cherry Chewables are back in inventory as of today. And again, you can call the number to get yours. Supply, call 877 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Now, we're going to go directly into listening to, it's a shorter version, but this is why you can't always assume that because someone says, I was a witness, that they are accurate. And this happens more often than not.
Small bedroom community of Linwood, California, just a few miles southeast of Los Angeles. Father came out of his house to tell his teenage son and his five friends that it was time for them to stop horsing around on the front lawn and on the sidewalk, to get home, finish their schoolwork, prepare themselves for bed. And as the father was administering these instructions, a car drove by, slowly. And just after it passed the father and the teenagers, a hand went out from the front passenger window, and bam, bam, killing the father. And the car sped off. The police investigating officers were amazingly efficient. They considered all the usual culprits, and in less than 24 hours, they had selected their suspect. Francisco Carrillo, a 17-year-old kid who lived about two or three blocks away from where the shooting occurred. They found photos of him. They prepared a photo array, and the day after the shooting, they showed it to one of the teenagers, and he said, that's the picture. That's the shooter I saw that killed the father. That was all a preliminary hearing judge had to listen to bind Mr. Carrillo over to stand trial for first-degree murder. In the investigation that followed before the actual trial, each of the other five teenagers was shown photographs, the same photo array. The picture that we best can determine was probably the one that they were shown. The photo array is in your bottom left-hand corner of these mug shots. The reason we're not sure absolutely is because of the nature of evidence preservation in our judicial system, but that's another whole TEDx talk for later. So at the actual trial, all six of the teenagers testified and indicated the identifications they had made in the photo array. He was convicted. He was sentenced to life imprisonment and transported to Folsom Prison. So what's wrong? Straightforward, fair trial, full investigation. Oh yes, no gun was ever found. No vehicle was ever identified as being the one in which the shooter had extended his arm. And no person was ever charged with being the driver of the shooter's vehicle. And Mr. Carrillo's alibi? Which of those parents here in the room might not lie concerning the whereabouts of your son or daughter in an investigation of a killing? Sent to prison, adamantly insisting on his innocence, which he has consistently for 21 years. So what's the problem? The problem is actually for this kind of case come manyfold from decades of scientific research involving human memory. First of all, we have all the statistical analyses from the Innocence Project work, where we know that we have, what, 250, 280 documented cases now where people have been wrongfully convicted and subsequently exonerated, some from death row, on the basis of later DNA analysis. And you know that over three-quarters of all of those cases of exoneration involved only eyewitness identification testimony during the trial that convicted them. We know that eyewitness identifications are fallible. The other comes from an interesting aspect of human memory, that's related to various brain functions, but I can sum up for the sake of brevity here in a simple line. The brain abhors a vacuum. Under the best of observation conditions, the absolute best, we only detect, encode, and store in our brains bits and pieces of the entire experience in front of us. And they're stored in different parts of the brain. So now when it's important for us to be able to recall what it was that we experienced, we have an incomplete, we have a partial store. And what happens? Below awareness, with no requirement for any kind of motivated processing, the brain fills in information that was not there, not originally stored. From inference, from speculation, from sources of information that came to you as the observer after the observation. But it happens without awareness such that you aren't even cognizant of it occurring. It's called reconstructed memories. It happens to us in all the aspects of our life, all the time. It was those two considerations, among others, reconstructed memory, the fact about the eyewitness fallibility, that was part of the instigation for a group of appeal attorneys led by an amazing lawyer named Ellen Eggers to pool their experience and their talents together and petition the Superior Court for a retrial for Francisco Carrillo. They retained me as a forensic neurophysiologist because I had expertise in eyewitness memory and identification, which obviously makes sense for this case, but also because I have expertise and testify about the nature of human night vision. Well, what's that got to do with this? Well, when you read through the case materials in this Carrillo case, one of the things that suddenly strikes you is that the investigating officers said the lighting was good at the crime scene, at the shooting. All the teenagers testified during the trial that they could see very well. But this occurred in mid-January in the Northern Hemisphere at 7 p.m. at night. So when I did the calculations for the lunar data and the solar data at that location on Earth at the time of the incident of the shooting, all right, it was well past the end of civil twilight and there was no moon up the night. So all the light in this area from the sun and the moon is what you see on the screen right here. The only lighting in that area had to come from artificial sources. And that's where I go out and I do the actual reconstruction of the scene with photometers, with various measures of illumination and various other measures of color perception, along with special cameras and high-speed film. Take all the measurements and record them, and then take photographs. And this is what the scene looked like at the time of the shooting from the position of the teenagers looking at the car going by and shooting. This is looking directly across the street from where they were standing. Remember the investigating officer's report said the lighting was good. Teenagers said they could see very well. This is looking down to the east where the shooting vehicle sped off. And this is the lighting directly behind the father and the teenagers. As you can see, it is at best poor. No one's going to call this well-lit, good lighting. And in fact, as nice as these pictures are, and the reason we take them is I knew I was going to have to testify in court, and a picture is worth more than 1,000 words when you're trying to communicate numbers, abstract concepts like lux, the international measurement of illumination, the Ishihara color perception test values. When you present those to people who are not well-versed in those aspects of science and that, they become salamanders in the noonday sun. It's like talking about the tangent of the visual angle, all right? Their eyes just glaze over, all right? A good forensic expert also has to be a good educator, a good communicator. And that's part of the reason why we take the pictures to show not only where the light sources are and what we call the spill, the distribution, but also so that it's easier for the trier of fact to understand the circumstances. So these are some of the pictures that, in fact, I use when I testify. But more importantly, were to me as a scientist, are those readings, the photometer readings, which I can then convert into actual predictions of the visual capability of the human eye under those circumstances. And from my readings that I recorded at the scene under the same solar and lunar conditions at the same time, so on and so forth, right, I could predict that there would be no reliable color perception, which is crucial for face recognition, and that there would be only scotopic vision, which means there'd be very little resolution, what we call boundary or edge detection, and that furthermore, because the eyes would have been totally dilated under this light, the depth of field, the distance at which you can focus and see details, would have been less than 18 inches away. I testified to that, to the court. And while the judge was very attentive, it had been a very, very long hearing for this petition for a retrial. And
we'll bring it down. Now, we don't have time to play it all, though it's on PRN.fm. Here's what he did. He got the judge to come out to the actual place where the shooting occurred. He then had the same time of day, the same identical location where the children were and teenagers were and where the shot father was. And he then, which was a little over 10 feet, and you heard what he just said, the actual close-up vision was about no more than 18 inches. And then he had a car at exactly the same time of day, the same time of year, go around the block. And it went by the judge, and someone held their hand out the window, holding something black as if it were a gun, and then going at the same speed down the block. He then told the judge, I'd like for you to do it again, except I'm going to make it easier. This time, he brought the car around the block, stopped the car right in front of the judge and brought the judge in to 3 feet from the car. 3 feet. He took photographs. And there was no moon that night, as there was on the shooting night. There was only some illuminating house lights from across the street. The judge could not see a single feature of the shooter. Not a single feature. Because the light from behind the car across the street shining in a witness's eyes blocked any vision. So even at 3 feet, let alone 10 feet, there was no vision. The judge saw this and dismissed, let this man out of let him out without bail, and they decided not to retry, and the man was found innocent and set free. That's just one of a lot of cases where eyewitness accounts are simply faulty or inaccurate. And yet we believe people with absolute certainty of what they saw or what they experienced, not including false memory, not including bias, not including all the different things that can happen in someone's mind that can change the facts. So that's why we have to be extremely careful and extremely diligent before we automatically accuse someone of a crime that could destroy their life. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.